given that, what does that do to our politics afterward? If there's an acquittal in the Senate by the president, what does this mean for the future? And I'm worried about what that means.
This episode is sponsored by Etched Communication, a full-service public relations and crisis management firm. Connect with Etched via their website at etchedcomm.com. That's etchedcomm.com. Today's guest could not be a more timely one. It is December 10th, 2019, as we are recording this interview. And just a few hours ago, the United States House of Representatives unveiled two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. Our guest today is Justin Dyer, who is the director of the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at one of my alma maters, University of Missouri, Columbia. And Justin, it is just a pleasure to have you here with us today. We met last week for the first time when you were here in Houston for a Missouri event with Nancy and Rich Kinder, the namesakes of the Kinder Institute. So I'm going to start by asking you to please share with our audience, what is the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy?
Well, thanks, Linda. Thank you for having me part of the conversation today. The Kinder Institute is a new interdisciplinary program at the University of Missouri focused on civic education and making civic education a vital part of what we do in higher education. And our real interest is in American founding thought and American founding history. And so the ideas and the events that go into the creation of our country and the way that it's developed over time.
So the Institute, I understand, was established in 2015, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So what led up to the founding of the Institute? It's my understanding also that this is a rather unique program in the United States, for sure.
Mm-hmm. There are a variety of programs nationally, and I think we're part of a national trend and on the front end of that in having a renewed focus in our colleges and universities on the American experiment, on the history of our country, and on civic education as part of higher education. It came together through a series of campus discussions among political scientists and historians interested in similar kinds of ideas and questions. And then we had the great fortune to connect with Rich and Nancy Kinder, and Rich Kinder is a history graduate from the University of Missouri, has a deep interest in this area, and they wanted to do something to give back to the University of Missouri. And so through those conversations, we launched the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy in 2015. And our goal through the programming has been to create a space for students and faculty and alums and folks from the community to get together and have serious but civil conversations about the ideas that go into American government and the events that have led us to this moment and thinking forward together about where do we go from here.
Serious but civil conversations, I would imagine easier said than done.
We've had a great experience with this, and I don't know how unique it is, but we have faculty from across the political spectrum, and I think part of what has led to our success is having that built in from the beginning. And so we have similar questions. We don't always come up with the same answers, but we're engaged in a joint intellectual project. And I think one of the things that's made that successful is keeping it on an intellectual plane, in focusing on scholarship and focusing on an intellectual conversation. And I mentioned this in Houston when we were together last, but I see what we do as both nonpartisan, and that's something we talk about, but maybe even pre-partisan, that before we get to our partisan divisions in American politics, we have to know something about what unites us and what holds this together, what the common glue is for our country. And part of that is a common understanding of our history and the ideas that go into the American experiment. And so we really tried to focus on that. I think we've, to a large degree, been successful at getting students together, talking with each other, talking across normal ideological and partisan and even disciplinary boundaries about these important questions.
So obviously students are a huge part of this program. You mentioned students and faculty, but you also mentioned community. How does the community play into the Kinder Institute?
We have really tried to break down some of those barriers that you often get between campus and the surrounding communities. And so we invite people into the intellectual life of the Kinder Institute, and it comes out in different ways. We have frequently what we call town and gown dinner conversations, where people will come in and listen to a speaker and engage in a conversation afterward. Just about any Friday afternoon, we'll have somebody giving a talk on American political thought or history in our seminar room, and people from the community come out for that. We'll often have 60 or 70 people on a Friday afternoon for one of those talks. And then we've started to do more, but we need to do even more than what we've done in terms of public engagement and bringing our scholarship to a broader public audience. We're a public land grant state university. One of the reasons why we exist is for our service to the community and service to the public. And so we want to do that with our scholarship and make that accessible as well.
2015, a very pivotal year. The 2016 election divided this country even more than it was already divided. I'm curious about any changes that you have seen in the dialogue that happens as part of the Institute's programming between 2015 and today.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Hard to know. We launched the Institute in 2015, and that was just a few weeks before we had some very high-profile protests on campus at the University of Missouri focused on the racial climate here and got national media attention. And and so we were right in the middle of that as we were launching the Kinder Institute. And then, of course, the 2016 election, which also had a polarizing and galvanizing effect on campus and in our community. And so it's kind of hard to know how to compare, because that's the environment we've been in since we started operating. In some ways, I think the students, and I've heard other faculty say this as well, they shy away more from the hard conversations. It's not that it's more acrimonious, it's that they don't want to have those conversations to begin with. And so they're less willing, I think, and it's anecdotal, but less willing to share and less willing to have that conversation, precisely because they want to avoid some of the conflict that comes from engaging in that conversation.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, the whole point of having civil discourse is that there has to be some discourse. So if you have students who are less willing to engage now, say, than they were 3 or 4 years ago, how do you overcome that? How do you get them to come to the table?
We've done it in a few different ways. And so thinking about the protests on our campus, focusing on the racial climate here, what we did was we partnered with the Department of Black Studies and we created a course called Race in the American Story. And that course focuses on primary source texts in American political thought, really 19th century, but then even going into the 20th century. And we created multiple sections of that class where students would all be reading the same texts and engaging in the same conversation with each other. And so that was one small way that we wanted to contribute to that and bring students from different perspectives together and have faculty moderating those conversations. One of the unique experiences that came from that is we had a faculty member at the Kinder and the chair of the Black Studies Department both left for other positions that year. And so one went to Arizona State, the other went to UMass Amherst. What happened from there is now we have a national program where students at UMass, students at Arizona State, and students at Mizzou are all reading the same syllabus, having the same conversations, and then this year they're going to meet together in Memphis at the National Civil Rights Museum to continue to engage in a serious conversation with people from different perspectives in different parts of the country. And so that was one way that we did it. Thinking about our faculty, Jeff Pasley is the associate director of the Kinder Institute, and Jeff and I are on different sides of the political spectrum, and so we wrote an op-ed piece for the Kansas City Star and used ourselves as an example of people who could be involved in a joint intellectual project, who could work together for years, who could have disagreements and still be friends. And so we try to hold that out as a model for our students, and we've invited the students to be part of that kind of conversation as well. And the students have reacted really well to that. I mentioned to you when you were in Houston, we've got a group of students who go to Washington, D.C. in the summer. And we have 20 students. They're living together. They're working for different think tanks and trade associations and different congressional offices. And they go out into D.C. They do their work during the day and they come home at night. And they're still friends. At least we hope that they're developing those friendships over the summer as they're living together. And so those are some small things that we're doing, but I think helpful things.
As the conversations get underway, say in the beginning stages of a student being in the program, are these conversations facilitated by a faculty member, or how do the conversations unfold, and how are you able to gauge and measure how the conversation changes from, say, the beginning through the middle of a course and then toward the end?
Some of them are more formal. We actually have deliberate conversations. And so we may have a speaker who comes in and we have, invite students to have coffee or dinner with a speaker and they'll moderate a conversation. Some of them are more informal. We have some students who are living together in a dorm on campus and engaged in our programming. And so they'll have a lot of informal conversations with each other. And some of those happen in the classroom and faculty have different approaches. And mine is that I try to keep our conversations on a level that doesn't invite partisan debate and discord, but has a shared mutual inquiry into some of the foundational ideas. And so to just give one example, I'm teaching a class called The American Constitution this semester. And in the American Constitution, we're looking at the structures and the powers and the distribution of powers in the Constitution. And the big hot topic today is impeachment. And so when we talk about impeachment, I want at a minimum our students, whatever they think about it, whatever they think about what should be done in the process, to at least understand the way the Constitution sets this up and understand the reason why the Constitution sets it up this way. And then from there, we can engage in a conversation. But trying to get the groundwork in place has been my approach in the classroom. And that leaves plenty of space for students to then have conversations. But it focuses it in an area that I think is really fruitful and helpful for the students.
So given the articles of impeachment that were unveiled today, I would imagine that you have in your mind how you're going to handle this in the classroom when you next see your students. So how will you handle that? What will you say? What's the approach?
I would want them to understand the constitutional structure of the impeachment process to begin with. And so we know that the House of Representatives is given the sole power of impeachment, and that's about all the Constitution says about it, about the House's role. It talks about what people can be impeached for, and that includes high crimes and misdemeanors. And so we have to have some conversation about what would constitute a high crime and misdemeanor and how we understand that. And then the sole power to try all impeachments is given to the Senate. And the Senate will sit essentially as a judicial body and try whoever's impeached, and in this case, it's the President of the United States. When the President is impeached, the Chief Justice will preside over that, precisely because the Vice President normally presides over the Senate. And of course, we don't want the Vice President presiding over the President's impeachment trial. Beyond that, the Constitution, I think, invites some conversation about and some political contest over what precisely constitutes an impeachable offense. That's a lot of what we've talked about today. And we can turn to history for some guidance in that. And so that would be the other place I would want to turn students, thinking about high crimes and misdemeanors in the English tradition that we inherited, what the conversation at the Constitutional Convention looked like as they were talking about what would be an impeachable offense. And then even thinking about some of our own examples from history. There are some fascinating ones, both people that we have impeached and people who we have not impeached. And often we have this sense in our own politics that we are at a moment that is more divisive and more partisan and more polarized than it's ever been. Looking at some historical examples can be helpful here as we think about the divisiveness and the partisanship that we have in our own politics. And there's often this thought that we are in an unprecedented moment of divisive and polarized and partisan politics. And so historical perspective can help us think through some of those questions. And one extreme example of that that's helpful, I think, for my students and that they find interesting is the example of Aaron Burr, sitting Vice President of the United States, who engages in a duel and kills Alexander Hamilton, the former Treasury Secretary. After the duel, he's indicted in two states, in New Jersey and New York, on murder charges. The charges are dropped in New York, I think, because the duel takes place in New Jersey. He flees those charges, eventually comes back to Washington, D.C., and he is not impeached over that affair and ultimately not convicted of a crime in those states. And so this is a really interesting moment. It's akin to thinking about Mike Pence, the sitting vice president, shooting and killing Timothy Geithner in a duel, and then not having any kind of formal impeachment charges come forward after that. And it brings up questions. What exactly is impeachable? This was action that was taken as a private citizen, not as part of public duties in his role as vice president. Is that an impeachable offense? Yes or no? What exactly constitutes a high crime and a misdemeanor under the Constitution? And who ultimately gets to judge? And I think that's the interesting interesting question for us today, and it's that the sole power of impeachment is given to the House of Representatives. And so you take what is ostensibly a legal procedure, an indictment, and you give that power to the legislature, to the House. And then it moves from there into the second part of that legal procedure, which is a trial. But the Senate sits for the trial. And so you invite political judgment and also political contestation over the whole impeachment process itself.
So much of the dialogue that's going on right now in this current situation revolves around whether these offenses of which the president is charged are actually impeachable offenses, mm-hmm. and it splits along party lines.
Yeah.
And what we've seen, you know, in these last months, even couple of years, is just each side digging in and looking at what I guess used to be a set of facts and not even agreeing on what the facts are.
Right.
The interpretation of the Constitution itself, the two sides are not even agreeing on that. So where do we go from here? How do we bring this country back together to a point where we can even look at the Constitution and say, this is what our founders intended?
You know, it was an interesting process where the House invited several professors to come and talk about what the founders intended when they created the impeachment process. And so I think to that extent, it was a heartening thing for people to start thinking again and revisiting the founding and thinking about the decisions that went into the creation of the Constitution. I don't know if our disagreements over that are all that new. Partly, you see those same kinds of disagreements cropping up very early after the Constitution, even by the people who were part of its creation. But we can, I think, have some guidance, and I don't know how helpful it is precisely because it's so broad in terms of what might constitute an impeachable offense. But here's my sense of things, that when the Constitution talks about high crimes and misdemeanors, it does not use those terms, either crime or misdemeanor, in a legal sense, so that it's not talking simply about criminal matters. Instead, it's a much broader term, and it's one that's borrowed as a term of art from the English common law. And it has to do something like official misconduct, or even a word that they would use at the time is maladministration of the government. And so something that could be, it would come short of being a legally defined crime, but nonetheless would be a maladministration of the government or a subversion of the Constitution in some way, could be grounds for impeachment under the high crimes and misdemeanors standard. But now the question is, who gets to decide whether such a high crime and misdemeanor has taken place? And the answer is the House of Representatives. And so it immediately creates a political process. And I think they weren't envisioning, certainly weren't at the moment envisioning, the creation of political parties and the structuring of the legislature by political parties. And so now what we have in this example is a partisan divide over whether the things happened as they are being discussed, divide over facts, and then a divide over the significance of what happened, over whether this does in fact constitute an impeachable offense. And I think that brings up all sorts of prudential calculations, both for Republicans and Democrats engaged in the process. Prudentially, what is the likelihood of a conviction in the Senate, given the partisan breakdown? And I think everybody agrees right now, there's next to no likelihood that you'd get a two-thirds vote in the Senate on conviction of the two charges that came from the House committee today. And so given that, what does that do to our politics afterward? If there's an acquittal in the Senate by the president, what does this mean for the future? And I'm worried about what that means for the future.
I was just going to ask you what your sense is in terms of whether we are in an actual constitutional crisis. What would constitute a constitutional crisis? Are we in?
I think some ways it's whether the procedures break down and people don't abide by the legitimacy of those procedures. And so what would be a bona fide constitutional crisis is if there is, say, an acquittal in the Senate and a significant portion of the country sees that as illegitimate and won't abide by it. And when you get to a true constitutional crisis, and this happens historically, is when you seek the forced removal of an executive officer from the presidency or an executive officer from the government. And so A true constitutional crisis, as we're thinking about it historically, would be something like a military coup, where you have truly a crisis, or people refusing to abide by the legitimacy of court decisions, or seeing the legislature itself as corrupt, or seeing the president as illegitimate. And I think all of those things could really constitute a crisis for us.
So one of the things you said was, if and I'm paraphrasing here, but to make sure I understand correctly, mm-hmm. So if the structure is not being followed according to what the Constitution says, which is that the House has oversight mm-hmm. and has the duty to oversee the executive branch, and the fact that an impeachment process is part of the Constitution as the House's right to institute that. And yeah. So the White House, as you know, has refused to cooperate with the process in terms of providing documents and not allowing witnesses to testify, mm-hmm. et cetera. Does that constitute not following the structure? Because there are those who would say that it does.
Yeah, so I think that the Constitution lays out a process to follow. And the process is, if you have a president that does not abide by the procedures of the House investigation, they have judged the president to then obstruct justice. The House can bring an article of impeachment against the president. So that's taken place now, and that's going to go to the full House later in the week. It'll then go to the Senate, and the other part of this process is the Senate will conduct a trial and decide whether the president's guilty under that standard and under the articles of impeachment that have been given by the House. So far, I think we have a very tense partisan moment in American politics, and we have political conflict that's structured along party lines. When it gets into a constitutional crisis, I think is when those procedures are themselves seen as illegitimate by a large number of citizens. So far, I think we see this procedure, at least as it's going forward, as the process that we're going to follow and abide by, so that the House has its role, the Senate has its role, and that remedy has been provided by the Constitution. If people think the president should be impeached and he's not, the blame lies with the Senate and the people that we've elected to the Senate. If people don't think he should have been indicted or have articles of impeachment brought against him, the blame lies with the House and the people we've elected to the House. So far, I don't see that as a constitutional crisis, but it's very, very close, because if we have a significant number of people who see the constitutional procedures themselves as illegitimate or inadequate, then I think we have a real crisis of governance and a crisis moving forward in terms of how we make these collective decisions together.
You said a moment ago that you're worried. What are you worried about?
I'm worried about our ability to have conversations together with a shared basis of facts. And when we have such a strong partisan divide, so that seemingly every bit of information can be filtered in one way or another, and there's no countervailing evidence that can be brought to change people's mind, that it's essentially a division in the country that rests with will and not reason, that we're willfully divided against each other, but not accessible to being reasoned out of a certain position. I think that's a dangerous place to be in for a democracy and for a mass democracy. We've got 330 million people in our country, and we are engaged in a project together to govern ourselves. And that's a fragile thing. And our country is still young in the annals of history. And so it's not the case that it will just always keep going and going well. I think it takes a lot of work to do that. And increasingly, it's something that we have to pay attention to.
Beyond the efforts of organizations or institutions like the Kinder Institute, and even having conversations like the one that we're having right now and the kind of conversations that I'm trying to foster with this podcast, what is the answer, do you believe? How do we get back to a point where we can agree on some shared facts, or we can agree to disagree, yet not demonize each other, and still be able to move forward with a thriving democracy?
It sounds cliche, but I think it requires a lot of people doing a small amount individually. You can only have an impact on so many people in your day-to-day life. And I think it becomes a daunting task if you start thinking about how you as an individual can contribute to the civic health of a nation as large as ours. But I think we can have an impact, a positive impact on the few people in our lives. And so thinking about the Kinder Institute, we have a significant, I think, deep impact on a small number of students who come through our program. And so we have a campus of about 30,000 students. From that, about 1,000 will be involved in our program one way or another. And beyond that, then there'll be 20 or 30 or 40 students who are deeply engaged and I think very meaningfully impacted by the kind of program that we do. When I think about that, it does leave me with the kind of question that you're asking. How, that's a drop in the bucket when we're thinking about the civic health of our town, our community, or our country. Only a small number of people are going to college. Only a fraction of those people are engaged in the kinds of programming that we're doing. And we have a lot of people to reach. And so how do we do that? I don't know. It's a big challenge. It's a big project. And I think we're all called to different places in our lives and we have different communities and people that we can impact. And I think it has to start there. It has to start small, but with those daily interactions that we have with real people in our lives.
I'm curious about your personal backstory in terms of your passion for this topic. Where does it come from and why is this so important to you?
You know, that's one of those things that you're interested in certain things and it's hard to pinpoint exactly why. As a high school student, my dad was a ATF officer, so he's federal law enforcement officer and a family background serving in the military. And so I think I had an interest in public affairs and government. And this is going to sound like a very odd, way to get here. But when I was in high school, I picked up a copy of C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. And we had a very modest assignment in our class, which was to pick up any book from the library and read it. And I saw this book. I thought it was interesting. And he has a first chapter called The Law of Human Nature. And it talks about the shared standards of right and wrong that we have access to by reason. This was a really fascinating idea to me when I read that. And I connected that later as an undergraduate with my courses on American political thought. And so you look at a document like the Declaration of Independence that says that we're all created equal and that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that it's basing our own national political life on this idea of a shared human nature and a shared foundation in reason. And so I was making connections between what I had been reading and what I was studying as an undergraduate. And then that soon turned into really a deep fascination with political philosophy and constitutional law. I ended up going to the University of Texas for graduate school, and I focused on public law and political theory there. And so it really just gripped me as both a high school student, as an undergraduate college student for some reason. And I've been really fortunate to do the kind of work that I've been able to do and to be engaged in these conversations with people in our community and students on campus. And I've really loved being part of that.
It's interesting that you talked about being exposed to political science and civics and all of that early in your academic career. Today's students, in many cases, are not getting that education in grammar school and high school. Yeah. I remember my civics classes and I remember memorizing the Declaration of Independence and having to pass a test on how, you know, the three branches of government. And I mean, there are people in this country who don't know that there are three branches of government and don't understand how they work because we're not teaching that anymore. So what are your thoughts on that and how we start to engage our young people in understanding this democracy in which they are privileged to live?
We need civic education at different levels, and certainly I think a renewed focus on civic education at the elementary and junior high and high school level. There's been, I think, some helpful movements in that way. The University of Missouri has recently required our incoming students to take what's akin to the national citizenship test before they can begin their studies here. And so we have some kind of renewed effort on civics in that way. But my own experience was similar to yours, but probably actually quite a bit less. And so thinking about what I did in high school and what we were exposed to and what we learned.
Because I am older than you are.
It was really college when I got to do a deep dive in some of this. And I took a class called Foundations of American Politics. And in that class, we read all of those core documents that you're talking about. We read political sermons of the founding era. We read the Lincoln-Douglas debates and Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. And I really loved that. Had I not taken that class, I wouldn't have been exposed to that and certainly would not have gotten that, I think, in my high school courses. And thinking about our educational system, then we have both a need for at least a basic set of requirements and a knowledge base for the citizens at large to know some basic things about American government, how it operates, how it works, civics 101, like you were talking about, which a really depressing number of people can't answer those basic questions about the branches of government and how our system works. At the higher education level, and I think the future leaders of our country, we equally need to invest in those students who are going to go on to lead, not just in public affairs, but in private life. The leaders of our industries and businesses and the entrepreneurs of the future, I think, need to have a connection to civics. There was an article in November of the Harvard Business Review, and it was about civics for business leaders. And it was a renewed call for civics education for business and business education. And it was sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce Foundation. And so it's a very interesting moment, I think, when a lot of different people in a lot of different contexts are thinking about the importance of civic education and how that plays a role both at the primary level and then later all the way on up to higher education.
I'm wondering if there's a story that might come to mind, either a personal story or one of maybe a couple of your students who started on opposite ends of the spectrum and maybe even had some friction. If there's something that you can share with us to explain maybe what that was and then how it was resolved and how you were able to come out on the other side, or maybe another person.
You know, they may have done a very good job of hiding that friction from us, because I have not actually been aware of very much discord on those partisan lines with our students. But I know that our students have developed deep friendship across these different boundaries, particularly in our DC program, where they're living together for 10 weeks during the summertime and working at different organizations. But we've had students who go through our program who are working at progressive think tanks and some who are working at conservative think tanks, and yet they're coming together in the seminar room and learning about early American political thought and history together. And we've seen some friendships flourish in that context. We've just put together a student advisory board for the Kinder Institute, and these are graduates. We're a young organization, so the graduates are still young and out doing interesting things, but some are clerking for judges that are on different sides of the ideological spectrum, and some are working. We've had students both involved in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party here in Missouri, and we've had students running for office. So I'm really hopeful that there'll be some positive stories to be told 10, 15 years from now about where those students are and what kind of work that they're doing.
And on a personal level, any epiphanies for you? Any, as you've kind of gone through this process, especially getting the Institute up and running?
So I did an op-ed piece with Jeff Pasley, who's the associate director, and we were trying to explain to everyone that it's really not as bad at the university as you think that it is, that we're working together, we're getting along, the partisan strife is not what it's made out to be, that our students are engaging with each other. Often all you get from the national media are stories of speakers that are being shouted down, students that are protesting certain ideas, the idea that there are topics that you can't bring up in the classroom. And that just hasn't been our experience or my experience. And so if there was an epiphany, it was that the university is doing better than people think it is. And I think it was kind of a hopeful message that we had, that there are people engaged in intellectual projects across these different boundaries, that they're working together, that the life of the mind is still alive and well in many parts of the university, and the students are really engaged in that. And so that's been a hopeful thing.
Do you have that same hope for our nation as a whole, beyond the university itself?
What worries me about our nation as a whole is the limited impact that even something like this conversation could have, a limited reach compared with our mass entertainment and the place that most people get their information. I think a lot of people are on Facebook and they're on Twitter and they're on Netflix, and the stream of information that they're getting are from sources like that. And those things have an ability to shape culture. And so the question of how do we get back to a place where people are deeply and meaningfully engaged in the lives of their communities. And that could start small and then extend to the national level. But I think we have some real challenges. This is not the place for this conversation, but there's an entire body of research on what's called social capital and the decline of social capital and really the interconnectedness of our communities. And that's one thing that we can empirically demonstrate has declined significantly over the last 20 or 30 years. And I think that has some real consequences for us as a nation if we don't figure out how to re-engage and reconnect.
The lack of human connection, in my opinion, that's been my epiphany in hosting this podcast for the last year. Almost every conversation that I've had about civil discourse and trying to find our way back to it has its roots in the lack of human connection.
Yep.
And until we find a way to reconnect with each other on a human level, we're going to face the challenges that we're facing now. Mm-hmm. So my last question to you is, if you could issue a call to action for Americans to help us find our way back toward a more healthy democracy and civil discourse, what would that call to action be?
I think some of it might be going back to our local communities. And you're talking about intimate human connection. And where does that take place? That takes place in our neighborhoods and in our families. And so we have a way in which our national media is focused on national issues and the partisan strife that goes with national issues. But we often have so much in common, particularly at the local level. And so engaging in our neighborhoods and our communities and our schools with our families, I think, is one very small and easy step we can take to help rebuild our country. And it can be done at the local level first.
Okay. Justin, I have really enjoyed this conversation. There's so much more that I want to talk to you about. I'd like to have a whole nother conversation about the media and all of this.
Yeah, let's do that again sometime.
We'll have to have a separate conversation where we talk about that. But in the meantime, I wish you and your students and the university the best as you move forward with the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy. We need you. We need what you are trying to accomplish. And I thank you so much for taking the time to share this with our audience.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving Justin permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. We'll see you again next time.